The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Bill Manny.
Good afternoon and welcome to City Club of Boise. I'm your moderator, Bill Manny. I'm an editor at the Idaho Statesman and past president of Boise City Club. I'd like to welcome our radio audience listening in on KBSX, Boise State Public Radio 91.5. City Club's forum series sponsors are Micron, Perkins Coie, who is with us today at a table and at our head table, as well as Echelon. And our media sponsors are Boise State Public Radio and Peppershock Media. Please join me in thanking them for their support. Before we begin today's program, I want to note for our radio audience the passing this week of Dottie Stimson. As many of you know, she was the founder and guiding light of City Club. In 1995, think of this, 1995, Dottie recognized that our civil dialogue and our public discussions had become hostile and closed-minded. So she decided to convene a group of her friends and perhaps twist a few arms to create the founding board and the original volunteers of City Club. And even in its 22nd year, we still ask ourselves, what would Dottie do? Forums like these are as critical today as they were in 1995. And we would not be gathered here together today were it not for her and her drive and her pluck and her commitment to open-mindedness and civil dialogue. And I'm sure Dottie would be pleased and impressed to know that we have 72 students in our audience today and would urge them to help us carry on this vital legacy. Okay, for today's program. For many of us in the western part of Idaho, the Idaho National Laboratory represents a vast and mysterious place. In fact, it's often just called the site. You get a peek of it as you drive to Yellowstone. That's kind of our experience with, at least my experience with the site. But we generally know that it was started around World War II. But did you know that it began in 1943 as a proving ground where the Navy test-fired fleet guns that were built in Pocatello? I see someone over there raising their eyes saying, I didn't know that. We generally know that in 1951 it produced the first atomic power to light electric lights. We know that it's had its share of criticism and controversy from worker safety to nuclear storage and cleanup. We know that Governors Cecil Andrus and Phil Batt fought like hell to get the waste there cleaned up and moved out. And the Attorney General continues today to refuse to accept even small shipments of spent nuclear fuel. And while that is a fight that doesn't involve our guests directly, it does affect the research that Mr. Peterson would like his lab to be doing there today. We know the site is a big economic driver for Idaho, and especially eastern Idaho. But do you know how big? The lab has 4,000 scientists and support staff and an annual budget of $900 million. And did you know that it helped develop the Navy's first nuclear propulsion system? That it helped produce batteries to power spacecraft to Pluto and Mars? That it does research on power grid reliability and security, and research on armor and explosives, and that it has a leading role in studying how to stop cyber attacks? Lab Director Mark Peters is with us today to introduce us to the lab, its work, its future, and then answer our questions. I'm going to call him Peterson. I'm not sure why. I think it's because I had a teacher named Mr. Peterson. So excuse me in advance for calling you Mr. Peterson, Mr. Peters. He came to INL in 2015. He has been associate lab director for Argonne National Laboratory outside Chicago and a senior scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Early in his career, Mr. Peters was a geochemistry research fellow at the California Institute of Technology. He has a doctorate in geophysical science from the University of Chicago and a bachelor's degree in geology from Auburn. And it won't surprise you to learn that he is an expert on nuclear fuel cycle technologies and nuclear waste management. So without further ado, I'd like you to welcome to Boise City Club, Mark Peters.
Afternoon. How's everybody doing? Good, good. Great to see the students. I'm going to make you stand up. Students need to stand up, seriously. I didn't know you were going to be here, so hopefully you came with lots of good questions. Political science, right, in general? So you're going to have a lot of good questions. So hopefully. Look forward to it. Bill, thanks for the kind introduction. It's a real honor to be here. I'm very sorry to hear of the passing of your founder. I will say that Idaho Falls has an equivalent of Boise City Club over in Idaho Falls now, and Twin's about to do the same thing. The whole idea of getting together and having the right kind of discourse about a wide range of subjects is something that I know we benefit a lot from over in Idaho Falls, and you started it over here, so appreciate that very much. Appreciate the City Club leadership having me here today. I want to, as Bill said, I want to talk a little bit about the laboratory, Idaho National Laboratory, the site, and then talk a little bit about looking to the future. And my remarks will be relatively brief because I want to give time for questions. I'm happy to answer any and all questions you might have. But I want to start with, Bill mentioned that there's cleanup things going on over there and other research things going on over there. So first and foremost, I want to describe a little bit about what I'm responsible for and what I'm not. There is a substantial cleanup mission at the site related to past management of production of nuclear fuel for the Navy and other weapons-related, I'll call it, activities in the past. And so there's a strong amount of funding that comes in from the government, from the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, to fund that cleanup. That is not managed by the laboratory, by Idaho National Laboratory. That is managed by a separate contract called Fluor of Idaho manages that contract. We have interfaces, but I don't have direct responsibility for the cleanup. But I know a lot about it, and I imagine there's probably questions in the audience about the cleanup. I'm happy to tell you what I know. But just to be clear, I work for a separate entity called Battelle Energy Alliance that manages the R&D laboratory, Idaho National Laboratory, for the government. So we have a contract with the government. I'm the lab director and also happen to be the president of that LLC. That's the way all of the 16 of the 17 Department of Energy national labs are managed, by private contractors. So it's important to make that distinction, and I think during questions we'll probably talk some about cleanup. I hope we do. Talk some about cleanup and the progress, but also how that's affecting some of the delays are affecting our ability to do our research, because I think that's a particular topic that I think you'd want to hear about. So let me go in a little bit more into the basics about the laboratory, building a little bit more on what you heard from Bill. It's had a long history, as Bill said, starts in the latest 40s, actually, as the National Reactor Testing Station. So there's been 52 reactors built, tested, demonstrated, some to failure, through the course of decades. So every nuclear power plant in the U.S. or around the world can trace its roots back to something having been tested here in Idaho. So it's an incredible, incredible history. The history book on the site's that thick. It's on my nightstand. I try to read about a page a night. It's pretty dense. But in 2005, it's gone through various iterations of management structure. But in 2005, with great support from the Idaho delegation, then Congressman Otter was involved, Senator Craig, Congressman Simpson. It was designated as the Idaho National Laboratory in 2005. Battelle Energy Alliance took over the operations at that point, and I've been fortunate enough to be the lab director for the last 2 years. We were designated at that time as a lead laboratory for nuclear energy research and development. So that builds off that history that we talked about. But as a national lab, you're always thinking about what's next. So we're working with industry to make sure that the current fleet of reactors in the U.S., which is currently 100 reactors, is sustained. They're under a certain amount of economic pressure right now that we could probably talk about in discussion if you're interested. But the laboratory provides support to the industry to make sure that there's a technical basis to continue safe and secure operation of those plants. But we're also thinking about what's next. What's the next generation of nuclear power look like? And I'll put to you that if you're serious about economic security, national security, job creation, but also protecting the climate, mitigating climate change, you have to think about nuclear energy as an important part of the mix. And so we're thinking about how do you develop that next generation of reactors, not only to produce electricity, but heat for the industrial sector, perhaps hydrogen production for the transportation sector. We're also thinking about how to deal with the vexing issue of what do you do with the spent fuel? How do you manage the spent fuel safely, securely, and dispose of it for the millennia that it needs to be isolated from the environment? So we're involved in all of that, scientists and engineers. We're also thinking about how do you actually take in the nuclear sector and actually accelerate innovation working with industry. So a lot of industry partnerships. We're an applied science and engineering lab. So we don't do a lot of fundamental science. A lot of our science is focused on outcomes that aren't just publications, but actually impacting things in the market in years to come. But one of the secrets, and Bill also alluded to this, is that we're not just nuclear energy. We're actually doing a lot of work in other parts of the energy space. We do a lot with batteries, for example, and advanced transportation, working a lot in the region on how to electrify the transportation sector, how to set up charging infrastructure across the West, the West Coast, the Mountain West, working with industry as well as university partners. Strong biomass program where we're thinking about how you can take biomass for multiple uses for energy and other products. But the area that's actually growing and right now the most is in our national and homeland security area. And I won't talk a lot about all the details. A couple areas of particular interest, I think, and Bill mentioned this as well, is cybersecurity. We're world leading in understanding how to protect infrastructure like the grid, like the transportation sector, like the natural gas infrastructure, all the way up to military platforms. How do you protect, say, aircraft carriers and submarines and the naval fleet from cyber attack? How do you defend that infrastructure? How does that infrastructure respond? How do you bring that infrastructure back up so that it's more resilient if it does, in fact, suffer an attack from a cyber attack? So it's world-leading capability, no kidding, sitting in Idaho, partnering with some other labs, partnering with universities, partnering with Boise State, the other universities. You put that together and you've got world-leading capability. When there was an attack on the grid in Ukraine, they took over a very, very small group. One of those people was from INL. So, you know, we're viewed as that level of expert. Because we have that big site, that 890 square miles that sits between Arco and Idaho Falls, we're able to actually do things out there. We have a standalone grid. We can run tests. We can test problems at scale. It provides a very unique capability that's really unrivaled when you look at across the national labs. I mentioned university partnerships. We are also an important part of what's called CAES, the Center for Advanced Energy Studies, which is a partnership with Boise State University, University of Idaho, Idaho State University, and now the University of Wyoming. We get a lot of generous support from the state for that. The universities bring their own resources. The laboratory brings resources. And it's a really terrific opportunity for not only furthering education missions, but also collaborating on big research projects. We've had great leadership in the past. We have some new refreshed leadership. The universities are working with the lab, and we're actually looking to CAES to do really, really big things in the next several years. And so keep an eye on that. But the partnership with the universities, the Idaho universities in particular, with the research universities, also the community colleges, we're very excited about having a new community college in Idaho Falls. already have collaborations with CNI, CWI, CSI, but now having CEI is a great thing for the eastern part of the state. But the partnerships with the universities are manifesting themselves in many ways. Cyber is a good example, a really interesting and growing partnership with Boise State University in cybersecurity. But the partnerships with the universities, I think, are about to take the next step. There's a common view amongst the lab and the universities about how we can work together to bring in more joint faculty appointments, engage more students at the undergraduate, graduate level, as well as postdocs moving back and forth. It's manifested itself in other ways. We just, in the last legislative session, got support from the state to actually construct two new buildings on our site in Idaho Falls, one focused on cybersecurity, one focused on advanced computing, that we would actually rent from we'll rent from the state. But it's got a very, very strong education mission in partnership with the research universities, research collaborations, but also a strong education mission. So we're hopeful that we'll break ground on those here after the ground thaws in the spring, whenever that happens. So we're very close to having, we hope, leases signed and whatnot. But an example of how I think the university partnership's taking the next step, but also how we're starting to make progress in the whole state recognizing the value of what we have when you have Idaho National Laboratory. Also want to mention, Bill also mentioned this, but people don't always know that we also work on sending things into space. So the way it works is you have basically nuclear batteries. They're powered by radioactive isotopes. In this case, an isotope of plutonium-238. We actually are an important part of not only producing that plutonium-238, but also putting it back into space vehicles that powered things like New Horizons. You know, Curiosity, the thing that roamed around on Mars, that has an INL engine in it. We're working now extensively with NASA on how to get back to Mars, say, the Mars 2020 mission. So anything that involves nuclear sort of comes together at Idaho National Laboratory. But one of the things that I'm particularly proud of is what we do in supporting our troops. Another unknown thing that we do out on the north, if you know the site, if you go through the north side up by Mud Lake, there's a place called Test Area North, big hangar you can sometimes see from the distance. That's where they tested back in the day, they tested a nuclear airplane. So they were actually thinking about flying airplanes run by nuclear reactors. They never, and really no pun intended, but they never really took off. Quite like they would have hoped, apparently. But it's fascinating stories. So they had the nuclear rocket program at the Nevada test site. The airplane program was here in Idaho. But what we do there now is we have a group of very talented people, most patriotic place you'll ever be. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff we can't show everybody. But if you come out there, you know, pledge allegiance every morning, the most patriotic part of the laboratory, I love going out there. But they actually manufacture tank armor for the Abrams tank for the Army. And they also are developing armor for the soldier. And there's great stories about individuals, soldiers or veterans coming out, active duty or veterans coming out and meeting the staff and saying, I've heard a couple stories about the soldier will look at them and say, so you did that? And they'll say, yeah. And the guy will say, well, you saved my life. So that gets you up in the morning, right? So that's just terrific. I've already mentioned a bit about the partnership with the state. It's terrific. The support from the state, the support from the congressional delegation, from the governor, from the legislature, and again, trying to continue to talk about with people like you all to understand what the lab is, what it brings to the state, and continuing to grow our partnerships. So that's kind of a quick run through of some of what we do. Happy to talk more about it in questions. In terms of what we bring to the state, some statistics, at least a quick one. You know, sixth largest private sector employer, about 3% of the GDP, so to speak. We're a growing organization. We subcontract to small business to the tune of about $130-ish million a year. So we're a big part of the state, and particularly the eastern part of the state. We're also bringing some interesting, I think we have the opportunity to be part of nucleating something even more substantial for the state in the nuclear energy area in particular. And I think that starts with an activity that some of you may have heard about. There's a company building a next generation reactor called a small modular reactor called NuScale that's based out of Corvallis, Oregon. And they're partnering with an organization called UAMPS, the Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems. It's a consortium of municipal utilities that includes Idaho Falls Power. Idaho Power is involved in more of an affiliate role. And they're actually world-leading, more safe reactor than is currently operating out there. They're looking to build this, export it across the world, U.S. standards for safety and security. But they have to have a first-of-a-kind build. And right now, their current intent is to build their first reactor on our site. So if you know the site, you head down 20 between Arco and Idaho Falls. You come to the junction with 26, right where 20 and 26 come together. If you know that spot, we call it the puzzle. The reactor goes on sort of the southeast side there. So that's what this place was started for. It was a National Reactor Testing Station. Should be the place that's developing that next generation. And so it's very exciting for us to be an important part of that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about. It's great that there's students here, high school students here, because I wanted to talk just briefly about the next generation. We're also heavily involved in pre-K through career, as you hear from the governor, but also particular K through 12 and how we can bring STEM, have more girls go to STEM and stay in STEM. Just get kids excited about STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. I'm sure that means something to this audience. We're investing a lot of our people's time, our resources, some of our corporate dollars. We're a leader across the state, working closely with the STEM Action Center that's been created by the governor. But that's very, very important to continue. I would also make a comment about diversity and inclusive diversity. Some of you may have seen that I've been saying some things about that publicly because I think it's very, very important. It's the right thing to do, but it's also important if you're going to seriously be a science and innovation leader, you better have an inclusive environment and a diverse workforce because that's the way magic happens. If you're a national lab and you're not, then you're in trouble. And I think we could all learn from that. I think, you know, the state's come a long way. But I've had a couple instances over in Idaho Falls involving folks in my own staff, as well as in the area that just bothered me. So I think we need to challenge ourselves to continue to push to make Idaho a welcome place to be. I feel welcome. Thanks. It's important. So with that, I think I'll just kind of wrap up. I do tremendously value the opportunity to come over and speak with you all today. I'm really looking forward to the questions because that's the fun part. So with that, I think I'll wrap up and turn it back over to Bill. Thank you very much for your attention.
For our radio audience, we want to remind you that you're listening to a forum by the City Club of Boise with the guest Mark Peters, the director of the Idaho National Laboratory. I want to correct an oversight. I did not recognize we have Lieutenant Governor Brad Little with us today. Thank you for joining us. So we have a lot of questions, and we have a lot of really smart people in this audience. A lot of questions about kind of where we are on nuclear research and the economics. So let's just start with this one. With U.S. electrical consumption apparently peaking, what is the future of nuclear power?
So it's about 20% currently, 19% now, of total electricity in the U.S. comes from nuclear energy. It's actually under a lot of pressure economically because of the structure of the electricity markets, but also because of the price of natural gas. So you're getting some premature retirements of existing plants. But there's also been recent developments by this administration that you need to think about how to value reliability and resilience more effectively. So that's a conversation that started. So if you bring that in, and I'll tell you my personal perspective is there should be some kind of price on carbon. That may be politically difficult, but if you add all those things in, nuclear has to be an important part of the future. But it's got these sort of near-term acute acute pressures that are more policy and economic and less technical.
Is there a collaboration between INL and Hanford regarding leaks and the experiences that they've had with cleanup, and what can you guys learn from each other?
There is some. Each of Hanford is up. Does Hanford mean anything to everybody? It's up in the Tri-Cities, so southeast Washington. There's actually a national lab there, Pacific Northwest National Lab, so they have a strong collaboration there. We do some limited support, but because there's a cleanup site in Idaho like there is there, there's a lot of crosstalk between the labs. A lot of our support is directly to the cleanup mission here in Idaho. So the challenges that they're facing right now, particularly with some of the high-level sodium-bearing liquid waste, we're extensively involved in providing support there.
This is a question that kind of puts it in perspective with other energy sources. Is investing more in nuclear energy worth it, considering the growing popularity of wind, solar, and hydropower?
Yes. What do you expect me to say, right? But I did say we do work on renewables too, right? And this isn't a political statement. It should be all of the above. That's what you heard from President Obama. That's what you're hearing from President Trump. It needs to be all of it. You cannot do this with just one source. And I'm in favor of what I'll characterize as a clean energy system. So I think there needs to be a lot of nuclear and a lot of renewables, is what I think. But you're going to need both if you're truly going to have a reliable, resilient system. So you need research in both to be able to get to that, to get to the right energy system, say, by 2050.
So can you just tell us a little bit about when was the last nuclear power plant built in the U.S.? What are the prospects for additional power plants? And can you also talk about U.S. Nuclear development in comparison with its use in other countries?
Yeah, that's big. So the last ones, it's been decades since the last nuclear reactor was completed in the U.S. We just brought Watts Bar back online in the southeast, but it had already been built and it was sort of sitting. There's four under construction in the southeast, two in South Carolina and two in Georgia. But you may have heard that the two in South Carolina have since been halted. So we're looking at right now, we're hopeful that there will be two additional reactors built in Georgia, larger reactors called AP1000 Westinghouse designs. And then the next one after that would be the reactor that I alluded to here in Idaho, the NuScale reactor. There are other nations, China, Russia, India, are all very actively, China's actively constructing new nuclear power stations. South Korea has just gone through an election, so there's some change politically. But also a lot of those countries are actively in the export market. What do I mean by that? As other countries are developing, say a country like Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, those countries are actually exporting their technologies to those countries. So when I say national security, one could argue that if the U.S. doesn't get back in the game, we will no longer be a provider of choice, and that affects your national security. Because we were the provider of choice back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We're perhaps not anymore. So there is a national security argument, and you'll hear that more from the current administration than perhaps you heard it from the previous administration. But the value proposition for nuclear is sort of like, I'll call it multi-pronged.
So this is a kind of a related question. Why hasn't the U.S. developed a French-style nuclear reactor where waste is stored on site?
Just for clarification, so we do store our spent fuel on site. What the French, I think what that's referring to is that the French actually are also pursuing reprocessing. But I don't know if you want to go there or not.
I'm happy. Not the expert on nuclear fuels.
Yeah, but well, the French have designs that the European pressurized water reactor, the EPR, that they've tried to market in the U.S. But all nuclear power plants have safe on-site storage. That's the clarification I'm trying to make. What the French do that's different than us is that they reprocess their spent fuel, meaning they take it and then they try to extract the uranium plutonium and make new fuel. Our policy is take the spent fuel and direct dispose. And the law says in Yucca Mountain. Do you know where everybody know Yucca Mountain? In Nevada, repository, national repository for spent fuel. Maybe we should talk about that, actually.
That's actually the next question.
Yeah, good,
which
good.
Which is, with Harry Reid now out of the Senate, can the Nevada site, already constructed, cave, quote unquote, be resurrected?
Yeah, so full disclosure, I worked there for 8 years, so in the cave. So I worked at the site, and now I worked at the cave. The license application was in Nuclear Regulatory Commission review. President Obama made the decision that it was not a viable project, withdrew the application. Senator Reid was Senate Majority Leader. He has since left the Senate. The hope was, and the policy of the land is build Yucca Mountain. That's the policy of the land. So the hope was is that with that change, we would move back to it. It has not moved that quickly, but the administration has made indications that they would like to get back to Yucca Mountain.
So the latest from the Trump administration is interest in reviving Yucca
Mountain. That's correct. That's correct.
A couple smart people have technical questions. Is there any way to process waste to eliminate the radioactive danger? Isn't there another element that could be used that could produce power that doesn't have the same hazards?
So let's take the back half of that first. So some would say that's fusion, right? Like this, what the sun does. And there'd be probably limited waste streams. The problem with fusion, the joke is it's always 50 years away. But the challenge with fusion is getting more energy out than you put in to actually run the reactor. Fusion's where you actually bring two light things together, right? And you make energy. Nuclear fission is where you break apart heavy stuff and you make energy. Reprocessing is possible, but you can't do it and completely eliminate the waste, is the bottom line. You can minimize the waste, you can minimize the half-life of what you have to dispose of, but you still need a repository to dispose of the shorter lived, less toxic material. But reprocessing comes with it other issues related to cost, but also the same technologies that you use to reprocess nuclear fuel for civilian use are the same, in general, the same technologies you could use to isolate plutonium to make a weapon. So there's that overlay of, should the U.S. be reprocessing if we're expecting the rest of the world not to reprocess?
We have another smart questioner who has a question right along those lines. What are we going to do with spent uranium now that it is no longer going into military arms and armament?
The national policy is to isolate it in deep geology. So, and that's scientifically viable. There's not a technical issue with doing that. The license application for Yucca Mountain I was personally involved in. I can tell you that I signed it, and my blood and sweat's all over it. And it's a scientifically viable. The challenge with geologic disposal and repositories is a not in my own backyard, not to minimize it, but it's a social political challenge versus a technical issue.
We have a couple of questions on kind of environmental aspects. How do you ensure that the nuclear energy waste isn't causing harm to our planet and our ongoing climate change issue? Is the use of nuclear energy being regulated in such a way to prevent furthering the emission of fossil fuels and endangering the planet?
Well, first and foremost, it's basically, I mean, if you look at a life cycle, let's talk about the CO2 emissions first. If you look at a life cycle, you have to drive a truck to mine the uranium, so it's not emissions free. But there's no CO2 coming out the stack of a nuclear reactor. So it's truly carbon friendly. That's perhaps not well understood. Now, the challenge is making sure that you isolate the spent fuel properly, because it's dangerous material. So you have to, it's being safely stored. It's being safely stored on our site waiting for Yucca Mountain or some repository to be developed. So we're very mindful of protecting the aquifer. Now, past weapons development activity have led to a significant cleanup challenge, but we've learned from that. So we know how to do it safely and securely. But the biggest vexing challenge for nuclear is solving that spent fuel challenge if you're serious about making it a viable part of our future.
It feels like we've coordinated these questions and answers, because the next question is, how has the cleanup efforts informed research and development of new technologies for the future?
So some of the waste streams that we're dealing with in the cleanup program, not only in Idaho but across the U.S., are pretty they're very complicated waste streams. So it's required a lot of scientific and engineering understanding of them. And a lot of the technologies that we're using to actually treat the waste, in some cases, are first of a kind and perhaps one of a kind. So we have learned a lot. We have one particular waste stream at INL that's probably getting a lot of visibility, that we're constructing a thing called the Integrated Waste Treatment Unit that's undergoing the delays that you sort of alluded to earlier. That's a particularly complicated waste stream. I'm becoming more confident it's being stored safely while we figure out how to treat it. But I'm more confident than I was, say, a year ago, that I think we're on the right path with treating that waste stream. But there has to be a lot of crosstalk, because these are very complicated challenges.
I'm going to ask you one last question, kind of about broad, and then we'll get into some specifics. But how do we convince a fearful public that nuclear power should be expanded?
Clearly, talking about it different than we have traditionally is what I would say, because the nuclear industry has not done as good a job of articulating the value of nuclear energy. My generation, when you would think weapons and mushroom clouds, you think Chernobyl, or you think Three Mile Island, and now you think Fukushima, right? Those accidents are very visible. One of the things that I'm excited about is that the environmental movement is starting to come around to understanding the value of nuclear, advanced nuclear in particular, because of the importance of mitigating climate change. So I think there's an opportunity to have a different conversation than we've had in the past. But the community has to get better at it.
What are your prospects for adequate funding of non-military and non-security related projects under the Trump administration? And I guess the larger question here is, do you anticipate that the mix of projects at the INL will change?
Not significantly. I think we're going to be okay, is the short answer. Right, Amy? Yeah, I think, you know, the security investment, the civil nuclear investment is I think going to be healthy. There has been a lot of dialogue with the Office of Management and Budget, who does the budget making for the president, about focusing the labs more on what they're characterizing as early stage R&D. And I said we're an applied lab, so we do a lot of stuff that gets pretty technologically mature, far down the technology readiness level for those who speak that language. But I think we're having a good, healthy conversation with the Department of Energy about the uniqueness of a lot of that work. So I'm optimistic. But there's clearly a view there of, cuts in federal funding are an overlay on all this. But the 18 budget was pretty grim. Here's where I bring up the fact that we've got strong congressional support. And in our particular case, we've got a gentleman by the name of Mike Simpson, who happens to be a big supporter of INL and the labs, and also happens to be the chair of the Subcommittee for Energy and Water Appropriations. So there's the politics for you. So that's helpful. But Mike values what the labs do. So that's very helpful. So I'm optimistic. I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting ride. Let's just put it that way.
So since you brought up politics,
yeah.
Questioner asks, what would you do if Raul Labrador is elected governor, who has not always been supportive of the lab?
Somebody really just asked me that question? Was that your question?
No. That may come from right over there.
Yeah, yeah. I doubt very seriously it came from there. I know Congressman Labrador because he's on the delegation, and we have good conversations. But what I'd say, I can't comment on the governor's race. What I would say is that I hope that we get the same support from the new governor that we get from this governor, because we get great support. And so I hope it just continues.
All right. Good answer to a tough question. One more political question, and then we'll move on to some interesting oddball questions. Rick Perry leads the Department of Energy. What experience, and he has experience in oil and gas, but he did visit INL. And did you, what sense did you get from him on his interest and support for nuclear energy?
So he did visit the lab. As his deputy chief of staff said, we drew the golden ticket. We were the first lab he visited, and I don't think that was an accident. So I had the opportunity to spend two solid days with them, in a lot of time with very small groups, and I'm very impressed with them, actually. You see what you see in the public face and all the other things that he's done in his career, but he's deeply committed to the labs. He's driving the president's agenda on how to revive the civil nuclear energy sector. And so we had great conversations about that. And so I feel nothing but positive about it. I also like his style. He's a CEO. And so I like somebody who just empowers me and holds me accountable. So I think things are very good there. People were worried, but I have nothing to worry about.
So a quick follow-up on DOE. You mentioned 16 of the 17 labs are managed by private contractors. But what share of the Department of Energy are the labs? Is it a fourth? Is it a half? Is it a tenth? How much of the Department of Energy is devoted to you and folks like you?
I would put it at about two-thirds. Two-thirds of the funding, plus or minus, maybe a little off, probably goes to the labs. Yeah.
So do you have any facilities in Boise that you can talk about? And before you answer that, let me remind our radio audience that you're listening to a City Club of Boise forum with Mark Peters, who is director of the Idaho National Laboratory.
We do have a small office here that John Revere and Ellie Brown, people in this audience know, are here full time. But what I would say about presence in Boise is, to me, the presence in Boise needs to be, in particular, collaborative with Boise State University. That's the way I view presence. I view presence as what's the collaboration, the intellectual collaboration with the university. So I'd say it's substantial. So and we're collaborating on some cyber stuff that was been provided state funding. I mentioned the buildings. So what I'm looking for in presence, I get the same question when I go to Pocatello, for example. And I say the same thing about ISU. It's important to me. Intellectual connections with the universities are the way that you establish that presence.
Do you work with Tesla on battery research? And maybe just could you tell us a little bit about the battery research, regardless of whether it's with Tesla or not?
I'm not aware of us working directly with Tesla. Tesla doesn't do a lot with national labs, by the way. They're highly proprietary in how they handle their information. But the secret sauce for them is their battery management system, for what it's worth. It's basically laptop batteries, but the way they manage them is the secret sauce. But our battery capability, we have a large battery testing capability. So if a company, a government, anybody wants to come and get, quote, the gold standard for testing, this is the energy density, this is the power that you get from the battery, that comes from INL. And so that testing capability leads to partnerships with a variety of different companies that are developing batteries. But not just the cathode material or the materials that are going into the guts of the battery, but also entire packs. We can test the whole range.
Are there other national labs doing battery research, or is it only at INL?
There's several. I was at Argonne previously. Argonne's got a very, very strong program in material science that's developing next generation materials for cathodes and anodes. Berkeley has a strong program. We have a collaboration with the Pacific Northwest from the Tri-Cities called BAT 500 that's looking for the next gen battery that'll drive a car 500 miles on a charge. So yes, there's a lot of expertise in the labs that gets taken advantage of by industry.
How close are we to that Holy Grail battery, 500 miles, the goal that everybody sees?
There's actually government funding going into projects. BAT 500 is an example. There's also a Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, which is a collaboration among university and industry, and they're targeting 5 years. I mean, Tesla would claim, what, 250, 300 miles on a charge? So you could imagine the breakthroughs are happening. In storage, the breakthroughs are happening amazingly. The innovation is incredible. So I wouldn't be surprised if you couldn't get to a 500-mile battery in, say, five, 7 years. Don't quote, don't hold me to it. But I'd bet you something on that.
So what you're saying is we probably can't drive our electric car to Idaho Falls yet.
Not quite. You don't have the charging infrastructure yet. Yeah. So you have to have charging infrastructure to have all that, and we're working on that too. But I think, I'm a big believer in electrification. I think we need to absolutely go crazy to try to get the transportation sector electrified, especially if where the electricity comes from is carbon free. I mean, if you're If you're burning coal to charge your car, you're kind of not getting where you need to go, right? And that's what's happening a lot, for example, in China.
Was the Stuxnet virus, which targeted the Iranian uranium enrichment centrifuges, try saying that four times quickly, was that developed at INL, and can you talk about it?
I can't talk about it.
You're standing at the microphone.
Yeah.
I think he wants to talk about it. Maybe you can tell us what is the heart of the cybersecurity research you're doing. I know you talked about control systems, but are we talking about utility plants? Are we talking about dam controls? What is the focus of the cyber?
No, I can certainly do that. So control systems are the little digital things that are the fundamental common technology platform across everything from the grid to a pacemaker to what runs a computer in your car, to what runs an aircraft carrier, to a submarine. Common technology platform, excuse me. We're able to actually understand those control systems, so it's across all infrastructures, and understand their vulnerabilities. And so we hire actually a lot of particularly young people who they're hackers, who understand how to actually attack these systems, but they do it in the context of how do you defend it. And so we're doing a lot of what I'll characterize as more fundamental work in the science area, a lot of engineering, but then we can also take that to the site and actually put it on the grid and attack it, if that makes sense. Right. And test things at scale. So it's a unique capability. And a lot of it's unclassified, but we do bridge into classified work in this area.
I'm kind of curious what a hacker job application would look like.
So good point. And also, I mean, we talked to the universities about how do you train those folks. That's an important pipeline issue. It's not always the traditional EE computer science programs that, you know, and it's also how do you keep them? Because once we train them up, then some other company wants to pay them six figures and they're gone. We pay well, but not quite that well. But what I would say, you know, the joke I tell is you walk through some of our buildings and you walk in and it's like you're in a basement. There's Batman posters everywhere. There's Superman stuff. You know, there's X-Men stuff everywhere. The lights are all turned way
pizza
down.
Pizza boxes.
No kidding. The lights are all turned down. And seriously, you walk through some of there and that's the kind. But the cool thing is these are hackers who are trying to protect national security. And that's why they're in it.
That would be a pretty cool career.
Yeah.
What kind of work is INL doing regarding small-scale modular reactors? And I guess I would add on to that. We see places like Puerto Rico when the entire national grid is essentially wiped out. And do you see a role either in emergency or disaster response or just in reconstruction of an economy like that for modular reactors? And how far away would realistic application or production be?
So I mentioned NuScale, the company in Oregon that's a small modular reactor concept. They would build modules in 50 megawatt modules, and that would have certain penetration into different areas. They're about 9-10 years away from first build as of right now, but there's actually new concepts that are even smaller, sort of 5 to 7 megawatts. And so if you follow the energy system, that gets interesting, and those are things you could stick, say, on a train or even an airplane. So you can imagine those are probably 8-10 years out from commercial. But there's some interesting concepts, and we're working with some of those companies. But those are the kinds of things you can imagine. Hurricane does what it did in Puerto Rico. Get it down there. It's literally almost, think about it as a nuclear battery. 5-7 megawatts in Puerto Rico would make a difference to power critical infrastructure and whatnot. So, and actually the Secretary's been going very public with post-hurricane in that hit Puerto Rico, it was Maria, right? Post-Maria, talked a lot about that, the importance of that. But he's tying it back to innovation at the labs because we're about 18 years away from having those. But we're doing a lot with it.
So a couple different questions about education and workforce. How are you making your workforce more diverse? What programs have you implemented, and how do you plan to integrate people of color? And let me just add to that another questioner who says, what initiatives are you planning for women in STEM?
We're doing quite a bit with women in STEM early in school. One example is we've got a great program with eighth grade girls that is, I think, been very successful. But also trying to attract more into not only bringing interns in as they get it along in high school and also as they're in college. What are we doing? Well, first of all, there isn't one solution to that. You've got to solve the pipeline early. You've got to have more girls going and getting interested in this. I have two daughters and one's in 10th grade. So I'm very, and perhaps she's slightly unique because I can talk about things at the dinner table that perhaps, you know, some can't, except for Stuxnet. That was a joke. But you know, you gotta attack it in a lot of different ways. But you know, part of it is me saying it's important. That's where it starts. And now I'm talking about diversity in general. But we've got to go out and be deliberate about recruiting people of color and bringing more women into the laboratory. Because if I showed you my statistics now, it doesn't reflect my commitment. We got work to do. And it isn't. It's pipeline. It's everything. It's with women in particular. If you bring a woman in, how do you make sure that there's the right balance if they decide they want to have? Universities deal with this too. How do you make sure you can retain women when they're in childbearing years? You got to provide policies that are friendly to that, friendly to families. And so we're doing a bunch of different things actually to try to attack that problem.
Are there any plans to shoot nuclear waste into space?
That's it was seriously thought about. Back in the 60s and 70s, there was a variety of different options looked at for how to dispose of nuclear waste. We went to ultimately deep geology, but shooting it into space was one of the considerations. I wasn't in the field at that time, but my understanding was a lot of the consideration was simply, as you can imagine, what happens if you have a particular transport vehicle have an explosion in the atmosphere and then you disperse the material. So that was that. I think that stopped the conversation pretty quick. But also burial in deep oceans is another option. Deep ocean burial is actually probably technically viable, but it's a policy issue about who owns the oceans.
All right, yes or no question. What's the future of thorium? I'm kidding you. What is the future of thorium?
That was my attempt at a joke.
Yeah, I got it. I was going to say, there's no such thing as a yes-no question with me. The thorium. So thorium is also a material that can be used to make fuel. The reactors that are operating in the U.S. are all uranium-based fuels. Thorium could be used. Some people sometimes confuse thorium with molten salt reactors. For those who follow this, molten salt reactors can be powered by uranium or thorium. We have a lot more uranium than thorium. It's viable. But it doesn't. A lot of the people who push thorium say it's totally safe, no waste, totally resistant to proliferation. Do a double click on that before you believe that, because it's got some of the same challenges that you face with uranium-based fuels. We don't have as much. We're awash in uranium, so I don't see a lot of thorium reactors here. Other countries, India has a lot of thorium, not a lot of uranium. The Scandinavians have a lot of thorium, no uranium, so they're probably more serious about thorium reactors.
So what's the layman's difference between this, what we use, and what thorium is?
I don't know the difference.
They're both radioactive. Actually, you're just using the thorium to get to uranium. Okay. So quite frankly, the fuel cycle is a little bit different, but for the purposes of a layman, you're just doing the same thing. You're creating an element that you split apart and you generate energy, and you have byproducts that you have to manage.
We keep getting really interesting questions. I wish we had another hour to ask all these questions. What can you say about Kaspersky, who is the Russian cyber technology manufacturer? And if you can't, well, let me ask you that question and also add, discuss your level of concern about the security of our electrical grid.
I can't say a lot about Kaspersky just because I know what it is, but I just don't know a lot personally about it. I do know there was a lot of discussion within DOE about how to deal with it, and I think it's being managed in the right way based on what I've been told. But I just don't have a lot of knowledge beyond that. But it does bring up the broader issue to your second question: how protected is the infrastructure? And the way I would characterize it is, it's protected, but the threat is real. I use a half a step ahead to articulate my concern. I'm very concerned about the cyber threat to our infrastructure. I think we're finally starting to ask the questions about how do we protect it, so I feel better about that. I also know that we have the tools and resources to address it. And the private sector is coming around to understanding that this is as serious as it is and working with the government more effectively. Just within the last year, I'm seeing real movement there, so I'm optimistic. But it's probably the existential threat for the U.S. right now, I would say.
And would you extend that same optimism for this questioner asked, what is your essential opinion of the nuclear state of our world? Dangerous, under control, step ahead, or one click toward midnight?
Yeah, he's referring to Bulletin of Atomic Scientists clock. I'm overall optimistic because I think that the countries that are out there building reactors are doing it safely, and the ones that are exporting, I think it's important that the U.S. continue to try to be out there to be an important leader. I mean, I worry, like all of us do as citizens, about what's going on in North Korea, for example, and hopefully the Iran situation doesn't change dramatically. But those are threats that are out there that are outside of the policy framework that we know works, if that makes sense. So, but I worry a lot about what's going on in North Korea.
Okay, last question. We're down to the last question, which is, what is the most interesting experiment you have conducted? And I would say at INL or elsewhere.
So when I worked at Yucca Mountain, one of the things that we had to understand is when you put spent fuel into rock, it heats it up, meaning actually like an oven. And so we did a large scale, about a test probably that heated up a volume of rock about half this room and understood how the water moved around and how the chemistry of the water changed. And we heated the rock for 4 years and then cooled it for 4 years and measured it. And I was the test manager for that. So it was incredible. So we Swiss cheesed it with boreholes, instrumented all the boreholes, and modeled it to predict what would happen. I got to tell one story, okay? So we modeled it to see what would happen, and we said, oh, yeah, we predicted this right. In general, we did all right. Well, Secretary Moniz, if people know the name Secretary Moniz, he was the previous secretary. He was the undersecretary at the time, and he came out, and we were having water outside of the heated area. It was dripping randomly, and I went through my spiel. Mr. Undersecretary, we understand this. We predicted it all, and the water drips right on his head. And so those who know Secretary Moniz, if you know him, says, so Mark, did you predict that? And what are you going to say? Well, no, sir, I did not. And he said, okay, we'll get back to work. Anyway, but it was a super cool test. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. We've been listening to Mark Peters, director of the Idaho National Laboratory. We'll present him with the City Club special thank you mug and say goodbye. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum is on the 8th of November and will investigate tiny homes with respect to Idaho's zoning and building codes, and panelists will discuss whether smaller homes will become more common in our communities. You can register for that lunch forum, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of coming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.